folks. Six listeners can't be wrong. It's episode 180 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Greg, what's going on, man?
Not much. Just getting ready to record this podcast and just hope that it records.
Seriously. Yeah, we're checking our record levels. We've had a few little hiccups on the recording. Yeah, so we're giving that a shot. Dude, what's new? What's exciting?
New Performance Menu website, performancemenu.com, is chugging along quite well.
Sweet. Sweet.
Good feedback from it so far. So that's pretty much the extent of the newness in my life.
Nice. Nice. I like it. That's more than I've got going on. Just met with the specialty health folks yesterday talking about the risk assessment program. We've got some cool stuff going on with that. Zoe's starting to walk, so we're figuring out that the things that we thought were safely out of her reach are in fact not out of her reach. So a little bit of scrambling to figure out the kid-proofing on that. But, you know, other than the fact that Reno keeps snowing, everything's pretty good. The past couple of days it's been snowing, and I thought that we're supposed to be into spring.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, it's bullshit. As Mestre Carrisco would say, it's bullshit.
Bullshit is.
What do we got? Podcast sponsors. How about FrontDeskHQ.com? We'll run with FrontDesk first here. FrontDeskHQ is your mobile solution, or it doesn't have to be mobile, like we said. It can be any darn platform that you want, but mobile is just kind of snazzy. But for running your service-based business, dog walking, kettlebells, CrossFit, stroller striding, you name it, you can run your business with FrontDeskHQ. You can do front-end, back-end, billing, deal with scheduling, you know, all the fun stuff that goes into running a service-based business. Then we've got the Performance Menu, the Journal of Nutrition and Athletic Excellence. You can read articles in like 50 different formats. You can read the whole article. You can read part of the article. You can get it on your smartphone. You can read it online. Greg, what else? Can it just be
Kindle
tattooed onto your Kindle? You can pump it to your Kindle now. For the love
of
God.
It's actually ridiculous how many options we've given you.
And Greg, what is that setting people back per year for a Performance Menu subscription?
$30 for a year.
$30.
That's nothing. Man. Or they can get really smart and go to a premium subscription for a hundo.
Nice. And what does the premium give them?
Gives you access to every issue ever, which right now that means 522 articles. And you get also a 15% discount in the Catalyst Athletics online store. So you can get books and DVDs and all that stuff for a premium subscriber price.
So if a premium subscriber gets in there, you know, pulls out the hundo, but a little bit less than $10 a month, they get all of the back issues, which includes all of my work on intermittent fasting, hormesis, hysteresis. If you want to play around with the zone, I wrote some articles on how to make the zone not suck quite as badly as it does, and a few other goodies. I think that my triple point of fitness piece was born in there, which was actually predated by years. The understanding that longevity was actually the fourth or third axis of fitness or whatever. I scooped many a fitness professional on that one. So, yeah.
Ha-ha. And it is documented for the world to see.
Surprise, cockbags. What else do we have? Let's see
Well
here.
Foods.
We've got wellfoodco.com. Go grab some chow. Wellborn's been putting a lot of work into the kind of sports supplement line within Wellfoods, but we have some really gym dandy meat sticks, jerky, some almond cookies that are pretty solid, so check all that stuff out. Did I forget it? Oh, the Bunny Ranch. I almost forgot the Bunny Ranch. How could I possibly do that? Go to bunnyranch.com. Clearly, it's a not safe for work deal. It's an adult site, folks. It's a brothel. People have sex. There's boobs. There's vaginas. There's all that stuff. So, you know, be forewarned before you go check it out. But super cool folks out there. We will be doing another talk out at the Bunny Ranch here in a couple of months. So we'll give you an update on that.
Kudos to the Bunny Ranch to talk.
Only you know, some Rob. Dudes do. Interesting.
It's, goodness.
It's funny. And then I happen to be one of those dudes, probably because my wife knows I'm going out there. And she told me that she would have a glitter detector, you know, that she could discern any type of, you know, nefarious activity on my part. So
nice.
We're good on that.
Cool. All right. Well, I think that about sums up the sponsorship part of the podcast.
Indeed. Indeed. It could sum up the whole podcast, actually. We could just wrap up. Probably people would be better off for the brevity, but I guess we'll muddle through nonetheless.
All right. It is our duty. Okay. Let's see here. This first one's asking me for an opinion, too, and I don't know if I have one. So let's. I hope yours is good, Rob. Anthony says, hello, I heard Chris Kresser have a cool answer to what his definition of health was. I was wondering what you and Greg's answers are. Question two, I was drinking water every day out of a styrofoam cup. Am I going to die earlier than the palm reader told me? Or did she know about the styrofoam? Stop spreading the good paleo word. The more paleo, or the more people that listen and learn, the less food for me.
That's
so, Rob, what is your cool definition of fitness? Or, sorry, health?
Well, I wish that he had put Kresser's definition in here so that I could pinch something out of that.
But, you know, yeah, like, I just want to reword his.
Yeah, because Chris is like 15 times smarter than I am. So, you know, I guess my definition of health is something to the effect that, you know, you have strength, conditioning, mobility, cognitive function, immune function that allows you to both do all the things that you generally want to do and are resilient to the, you know, the vagaries that life can throw at you. Like if you're, you know, your kids get sick and you need to be up a couple of days with them, if you need to do a cross country drive or something like that, you can weather it out. I still am continually impressed with Art Devaney. You know, the dude's pushing 76 and he's lean and strong and jacked and smart. When we did our piece out in New York, he had just had some eye surgery maybe 2 weeks before the ABC Nightline show was to be filmed in New York, and then Art lives in southern Utah. So he had to drive to New York in 3 days, which is a not insignificant drive just as a baseline. But he couldn't take a direct route because of the eye surgery. He couldn't go over any mountain passes that were higher than 2,000 feet. So he had to like drive down through the South and then like skirt the Appalachians. And he had a reasonably circuitous route. And, you know, he drove 750, 800 miles a day on these days and then showed up and was a little tired, but, you know, did a workout with us and was, you know, totally on it. And so for me, I you know, kind of what Art's got going on, where he's lean, strong, muscular. He does the stuff that he likes to do. He rarely gets sick. He's probably going to live to be 90 and then keel over and croak, and that'll be that. That seems pretty solid to me.
Yeah, I don't know that I have a whole lot to add to that. I mean, I honestly don't mean to be like a smartass, but I kind of like the standard dictionary definition of health, which is just the absence of sickness.
Right.
I mean, it just means that you're functioning properly. There's no problems. I mean, I don't really think fitness and health are the same thing. I do think those are different things, and I think they go together, obviously. But I do think fitness is somewhat circumstance or task specific. So I don't think you can wrap them up neatly into one definition, unfortunately. And I know that bums a lot of people out, but that's just me. I'm a bit of a curmudgeon.
Well,
and I'll probably die at 45, so. So that's it.
But leave a good-looking corpse, so, you know.
Yeah,
that'll, exactly. That'll be good. Question two, drinking water out of a styrofoam cup every day. You know, I don't think you're going to die from it. Penis may fall off, but we won't worry too much about that. My big concern with like any type of plastic item is more if you have some sort of high temperature associated with the plastic item. Like, I really wouldn't be fired up about, you know, microwaving water in a plastic, in a styrofoam cup and then drinking it. If I'm freezing my fanny off and somebody gives me a cup of, you know,
hot coffee or something in a styrofoam cup, I'm probably not going to turn my nose up at it the one or two times that happens. But on a daily, the temperature deal is really the big piece to that. And then also, like, if you were to, let's say, throw some whole whipping cream in with a plastic contain, you know, you have a styrofoam cup, hot coffee, lots of whole cream. The plastics and plasticizers are lipid soluble. They're nonpolar. And so I wouldn't throw a bunch of like whole whipping cream or like just fill the cup with coconut oil and then drink that. That seems like a legitimately bad idea. But, you know, other than that, I wouldn't really be too freaked out about it.
Sweet.
And I know Greg would just live with reckless abandon and wouldn't really give too much thought about that one way or the other. So
live dangerously. Yeah, no, I don't. That stuff, it does worry me a little bit, but I get more worried about the kind of estrogen type stuff than I do about any other health related thing.
Yeah. I think xenoestrogens are a big potential problem. I'm bummed that there aren't more xenotestosterone agents, but
seriously,
what are you going to do?
It's bullshit. Okay. All right. Let's see here. Checking in from an old listener, it looks like. Nainoa, I'm so sorry. I know I'm mispronouncing that name, but I am not Hawaiian or Polynesian of any kind. Aloha, my idols. I am back, one of your original six listeners and benefactor of episode 29's great advice. Thank you. I'm going to buck tradition and just start with my question. Do you think that there could be a special paleo intervention for food addicts? Some examples might include weighing and measuring or an addiction program. I wonder what the research might say about a detox period where you avoid intense flavors and even mixing food to change the pathways in your mind. Update. Since episode 29, I have lost well over 45 kilos.
Nice.
From as high as 159 kilos to just over 90 now. From a 54-inch waist to 34 now. I did it all without exercise until most recently. So I am not the beast I was when I last wrote, but I've been greasing the groove and doing power to the people and can feel my Polynesian genes activating and my new body is revealing a previously hidden side of my athleticism. Just, quote, going paleo didn't work for me. I would be able to eat paleo for a good month or two, but still couldn't lose weight because, first, I could just put down that much nuts, fruit, and sweet potatoes. Secondly, I could not let go of the frickin' cheat night. I needed my fix. Unfortunately, the binge nights turned into days and I stayed fat. I lost my weight during a 12-step food addiction program that is pretty paleo. For my detox, I've eaten 8-ounce Greek yogurt, 6-ounce fruit, and 1 ounce of oatmeal for breakfast. Dinner and lunch are 6-ounce lean meat, 10-ounce cold veggies, plus 1 tablespoon no-carb dressing, and 6-ounce steamed veggies. I ask this question because I feel there might be those who fall through the cracks, not for lack of willpower or guts, but who, like me, suffer from an addiction to food. They may come off weak or stubborn, but in reality are just slaves to the chemistry of their brains. Maybe more could be reached with a special addiction intervention. Thanks for all you do. I am personally so grateful to you.
Man, one, that's just a really kick-ass story and a phenomenal transformation. And I think it just illustrates that, you know, we have some general guidelines that I think get people hopefully within striking distance of having something that works. But then we need to stay open to having different tools. You know, I'm not at all an addiction expert, not even remotely. You know, coffee was my main vice. I've steered clear of the white drugs because everybody in my family seems to have multiple chemical dependency issues. So I've been around addiction enough to know that I don't want to get addicted to much of anything. I've been able to, for the most part, I guess, dodge the food addiction piece. I know Stefan Guiné has talked about trying to restore the normal neuroregulation of appetite. He will recommend single, you know, foods. So you would eat some protein, and then at another meal you would eat some starch, and another meal you would eat some veggies. No seasonings, no nothing. Like not mixing foods. Just you know, as basic and plain as you could get. And the deal with that is that we start rewiring the normal neuroregulation of appetite, so we can actually taste things and feel textures, and we can smell the food while we're eating it and chewing it and everything, which all of that stuff plays into the satiety circuitry. And, like, you know, it's interesting, even as you pointed out here, that even our good old classic, you know, paleo foods, they can be overconsumed. You know, clearly, I talked about that in my book. We've talked about that elsewhere. For a lot of people, that's a good enough step, just eating basic paleo. But for a lot of people, they need to take some further steps. The weighing and measuring piece is interesting to me because that is something that in my clinical practice running a gym, I've actually seen people go off the deep end with that and actually get some you know, eating disorder, anorexia, bulimia type stuff. So I've been really nervous about that, but it sounds like the weighing and measuring of the food was actually part of your 12-step food addiction program. So I would actually be really interested to learn more about that because I've honestly been nervous about that stuff. So I think that there certainly are a number of people who would benefit from more information, more guidance in this area. Like I said, it is just not my area of expertise at all, but it seems like a smart kind of option that somebody could put together, which is, you know, kind of a evolutionary medicine oriented food intervention that it helps rewire the normal circuitry, and then you get back in, and just like addicts in other situations, you have to get out and live the rest of your life and figure out how to interact with those items, which are triggers. And the food addiction piece is so challenging because you have to eat. Like if you're a heroin addict, like you could cut out your friends and quit being a rock star, or, you know, whatever it is that allows you to have access to that stuff. And clearly you can always seek it out, and that stuff is always available, even though it's illegal and all the rest of that stuff. But if you found it once, typically you can find it again. But there are, you know, whether it's alcohol or you know, illegal drugs or whatever, I think that there are easier ways to create a barrier between yourself and interacting with those items. Whereas food, you are going to eat, and you are, you know, the challenging food items, which is virtually everything under the sun at this point, those are going to be around you constantly. And so like it's a huge challenge. And I have no real depth of knowledge in that other than, you know, I think that there are some good ideas as far as limiting the complexity of foods and limiting seasonings and really trying to focus on reestablishing the normal neuroregulation of appetite. And then I think all the other pieces come into play, you know, getting good sleep, getting some exercise, having a normal photo period so that, you know, the wake sleep cycles are good, and those things play into normal neurochemistry. Like, I think we try to stack the deck as much as we can on just generally being healthy and feeling good and making sure that the brain is firing on all cylinders. And I think that that's the, within my sphere of knowledge and experience, that's the best that we could do. And then beyond that, like these 12-step programs, it'd be really interesting if somebody tackled it from an evolutionary biology perspective, for sure. You got anything?
I was just going to suggest that she start smoking, but I don't think that's probably the best way to go about this.
Trading one for another? Yeah.
It's the methadone protocol.
I like it.
Okay. Let's see here. Michael says, have you guys read or heard about this? And there is a link to an article on robreinhart.com. It says, this article is very seductive to read. It goes against everything we believe right now, but the effects the media have extrapolated it could have on world hunger, agriculture, obesity, food poverty, and the military are profound. Ignore the name. It's not soy-based from what I can see. I think it's called Soylent Me. It's papal. In having followed FDA recommendations, I'm sure we could get things to a much better place with tweaking the formula provided with what we know as a community. What are your thoughts? What would the long-term effects of living on a, quote, adult formula be? Rob set up a site to enlist recruits for informal trials. Greg, you're going to hate it, I'm sure, but could this be a revolution in cutting food expenditure waistlines around the world, and in doing so, ramping up overall productivity for those willing to forego the enjoyment of food? Oh, boy. Rob, you got lead on this one.
You know, it's really interesting, and like you know, when we look at like the Roy Walford life extension attempt, the CRAN, caloric restriction, adequate nutrition, that wasn't far off of this. In some ways, they were eating whole foods for the most part, and then taking some nutritional supplements to kind of fill in the gaps. Do Do I think that somebody could eat this way long term and be healthy? Yeah, I think they probably could. Looking at our previous question and dealing with food addiction and stuff like that, like it's interesting. Like Hamilton Staple, he's a professor of history at State University of New York in New Paltz. He did a talk at AHS last year talking about the history of the ancestral health movement and kind of some parallels between ancestral health, paleo, and the physical culture movement of the early 1900s. And then this year at Paleo FX, he did a talk kind of looking at the current state of the ancestral health movement. And he did a survey, which he had like almost 5,000 respondents to the survey. And, you know, people in the ancestral health movement are largely white, highly educated, reasonably well off, et cetera, et cetera. And what he found, and this just kind of validates what we've seen before, people kind of eating paleo, they seem to come from two highly motivated extremes. One is from people who are sick, and the other one is from people who are looking to gain a performance edge. And so these people are highly motivated to do something different. And he's very kind of morose about the likelihood of the paleo diet, ancestral health concept really going mainstream. And if you look at veganism, I think it's got like maybe veganism, vegetarianism, it has maybe like a 1% penetration into the population. I think that you get a little bit more than that at various times. The fact that you can eat vegan hockey pucks made out of, you know, sugar and starch, and they taste pretty amazing. I think that kind of greases the wheels on that a little bit. But still, like, that concept's been around a long time. There's all this kind of moralizing around it and whatnot. And you have a limited buy-in on the topic. And so if we head further over and start asking people to eat, nutrient-enriched protein powders, basically, I just don't know that it's really going to get any type of traction. As it is, we're asking people to eat bacon and steak and sweet potatoes, and we get some people who twist their panties and get all bent out of shape at that, because we're suggesting that they don't eat Eggo waffles every single day, and it's just too onerous a gig for them to eat meat, fruit, veggies, and sweet potatoes for the most part. So so if we're facing a situation where food like that is maybe not going to be palatable enough to get people off of Big Gulps and Twinkies, then I don't know that we're really going to get any type of a buy-in on this other thing. And some of the sustainability piece on this, I didn't take a huge amount of time to look at that, but you still have to produce this stuff. Like I've had a blog post I've been working on. A lot of the vegan athletes, virtually all the vegan athletes I've ever followed, all of them use protein powder. And so there's this, which is kind of funny to me, because they make this point. They're like, you don't need protein from animals to be successful. But what they show is that you definitely need protein levels above and beyond what you can get from beans and rice to be successful. Otherwise, they wouldn't do the hemp protein and all the rest of that stuff. But people completely neglect the energetic costs of producing that stuff, processing it, putting it into a can, all the rest of that. It might end up being a little bit more energetically feasible than say, like grain-fed meat, but it definitely isn't going to be better than grass-fed meat. So from the sustainability standpoint, I would just be interested in getting in and taking a bigger look at all that stuff. So I don't know that it's immediately as great an upside as what they're saying. Maybe it is, but I haven't done that much look into it. So I guess to recap, I think you could probably eat like this long term and probably be just fine. I don't know that you're going to produce any type of earth-shaking athletic performance on it, but I guess similar to the health question, you could probably motor along and possibly show no overt signs of illness. If it is really soy-based, it'd be interesting to know the goitrogenic effects on it. Somebody consuming a ton of this stuff and what that would mean for their thyroid. As far as long-term buy-in, if paleo is fringe and is unlikely to go mainstream, then I think this is really, really freaking fringe and definitely not going to go mainstream. Like if we can't fire people up about having some bacon and eggs and fruit for breakfast, I don't know that we're going to really get them fired up about soiling me over the long haul.
Yeah.
Great thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I don't see how really this is a solution to anything at all. And maybe I'm incredibly cynical, which I am admittedly, but when you talk about the, oh, we're going to solve world hunger and all this stuff, sustainability with a product like this, it doesn't make any sense because, like Rob said, you still have to produce it. And that means you still have the people now who are currently basically dependent on someone else to produce and provide their food. They're still going to be in that same position. It's just going to be this food instead of a different kind of food. And it doesn't address any of the actual underlying problems, which is the fact that we have an exploding population and we don't know how to support it in a sustainable manner. So I don't know. Like I said, maybe I'm a dick and I'm in a worse mood than usual today, but I just don't get it. I don't see how this is going to help anything. And you're going to have people drinking what looks like cups full of piss instead of being dependent on someone else's cornmeal and rice or whatever. Terrible.
This one to me is a little bit like the Twinkie diet experiment where you had the chubby nutrition professor who ate nothing but Twinkies, but, you know, calorie restricted and lost weight, improved his blood lipid parameters, but was still chubby at the end of the experiment. And that got a bunch of hoopla. But, you know, I mean, the hormonal underpinnings of health and wellness and body composition are clearly important. I think as time has gone on, I've shifted more and more towards the, you know, a little bit more of a calorie being very, very important in this whole story. But clearly even that has nuance to it. If somebody has low thyroid or their growth hormone signaling is buggered or they're insulin resistant, then we're going to get very different effects versus if all that stuff is normalized. And let's just let that one die.
Yeah. Boy. Okay. Glycogen storage and depletion. Thomas says, Robin Gregg, been listening since day one and can't get enough of the invaluable information and witty banter. Keep it up. Even though I've given it a gentleman's try, I can't seem to find any definitive information on the amount of glycogen that we burn at a resting and or sleeping state. I feel like I need to know this stuff for a cyclic low carb or backloading to be effective. I also can't find info on the amount of consumed carbohydrates we can convert to glycogen both post-workout and during other parts of the day. I'm just trying to kick some ass like everyone else. Please help me kick some ass.
Oh, man. You know, so I'm assuming that we're talking liver glycogen here, and there are some rough numbers of that. I mean, the reason why you probably didn't find anything is nobody knows. Like, there are some rough guidelines, you know, that if you've got, you know, your typical like 70 kilogram male and this body composition, that we're going to see a tight, and then we started fasting this individual, and we're assuming that his liver was topped off with glycogen. I see, even within that, depending on if the person is trained or untrained, whether they've been practicing some cyclic low carb approaches or not, we can have like two, three, four times the difference in how much carbohydrate is stored either in the muscles or in the liver. And so we can have a really huge difference in what our starting point is. But let's assume that we've got like 250 grams of glucose stored as glycogen in the liver, and then we need to maintain a blood glucose level of say like 80 or 85, and that means that we're going to have something like 5 milligrams of glucose titrated into the blood every, you know, like 20 minutes or something like that. I forget what the exact numbers on all are on all that stuff, but there are some rough metabolic guidelines that you can follow. But any amount of exercise, any amount of illness, stress, and all those numbers just go out the window. Like, it becomes completely nutso to get any type of a grasp on this. And this is why most things like Mauro Di Pasquale stuff or carb backloading, they give you some basic guidelines, and then you need to play within that to see whether or not you are getting enough muscle glycogen repletion so that you can do the type of activity you need, or you getting too much muscle glycogen repletion, too many calories, and you're starting to gain body fat at a unnecessary or untoward level. I mean, I saw in the second piece here, how much carbohydrate can you convert to glycogen post-workout? That is really dubious to me also. Like most, I saw a good website. I forget it. It's, God, I'm totally blanking on the guy's name, but he's kind of the science guy who's on Superhuman Radio frequently, and I'm completely blanking on his name, Professor Andro or something like that. And he had a kind of an analysis on this, and I think he was putting the number at like about 0.25 grams per pound of lean body mass post-workout was kind of the top that you could see as far as getting immediate glycogen resynthesis. But this was in folks doing like a standard like weight training kind of protocol. I haven't seen any type of data on this, but I've got to guess that something like a really hard CrossFit workout would totally blow that out of the water, because you're hitting like every muscle fiber on some of these things, from like your earlobes to your toenails. You're not just hitting them, but you're driving them to exhaustion, completely, you know, knackering and tanking these things. And that's where with CrossFit athletes, I've actually seen benefit of carbohydrate intake post-workout on these big burners way above what I see in virtually anybody else. The only thing coming close to it is kind of MMA athletes when they're doing a really hard grappling or sparring session. And even that, I typically see the CrossFitters seem to benefit from even more carbs post-workout as far as kind of a recovery deal. So these are interesting questions, but I think you're possibly overthinking things. Like the basic guidelines that you usually get out of something like an anabolic diet or the carb backloading will get you within striking distance, and then you just need to tinker with how the recovery is going, how the body composition is going, and that's going to give you a little bit of fiddling back and forth. And all of that, let's just say I put out some sort of number here, and now let's say that your work environment changes so that you went from being relatively sedentary to now be on your feet running around all day. That's going to completely change these numbers. So I mean, there's so much individuality and customization potential there that any type of you're going to get nothing more than a guideline, and the guideline is going to get you within spitting distance of where you need to be, and then you're going to have to just pay attention to what you're doing to be able to get it really dialed in.
Yeah, this sounds like a recipe for like serious neurosis right here.
Yeah. I can't see anything good come out of that level of scrutiny relative to just using a basic protocol, get close, and then see how you look, feel, and perform, and make adjustments based on those goals and those parameters. Yeah.
Okay. Outback workout. Liam says, Robin Gregg, I'm moving into Outback Australia for work. Needless to say, unless I purchase a fighter jet, I'll be unable to make it to a gym. A single kettlebell and TRX, enough to stay jacked? How would you structure it? Goals to simply maintain some sort of physical nature. Thanks, boys. Well, the question is, if a single kettlebell and TRX is enough to stay jacked, the question is, are you already jacked?
Yeah.
Because I've seen that question before.
Maintenance is way easier, yeah.
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 If you are already jacked and you're eating well, then that's probably enough to stay jacked.
Yeah.
If you are... Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think like a TRX or a set of gymnastics rings for the upper body, if you follow Chris Summers' stuff, if you follow Ido Portal's stuff, like there's some great progressions within all that, some body weight strength stuff, one arm chins, handstand push-ups on the rings, front levers, back levers, you know, skin the cats, all that sort of jive. Like you can hit the upper body pretty good. I think, you know, even without a kettlebell, you can do some pretty nice work with pistols. It's not too hard to rig up some sort of a sled to either push or pull for some posterior chain work. Do some bounding, box jumps, sprints, and I think you could have a nice program built around that. And you know, just some sort of gymnastics ring kind of apparatus for some of the upper body, like you can do handstand push-ups. I think that would be a great time to get really, really good at some handstand walking, one-arm chins, get some sort of a sled to push and pull, do some lunges, do some sprints. I think he could be in pretty damn good shape and have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. There you go. Okay. I feel like this one has been covered several times. The next two actually
times.
Have been covered a million times. But yeah. Nick Hawk says, gentle people. I don't know who he's talking to. Was wondering what your thoughts are on sleeping in total darkness. I hear you hitting on it a bunch as part of the total paleo lifestyle, but I feel like I'm missing some info. I sleep outside pretty regularly and have noticed that no matter where I am, near a city or out in the wilds, there's always some ambient light. On full moon nights, you can forget about any kind of dark time. How could we have evolved to sleep in total darkness if we never or rarely actually experienced that condition? Cheers and fuck yeah. That's an odd.
So I did a very extensive blog post on this maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. And the problem that we face is that our photo period is just kind of goofy compared to what it used to be in the past. We have electric lights, which when we get the blue and green wavelengths of light going into our eyes, that communicates with the hypothalamus, and that tends to suppress the conversion of serotonin to melatonin, and so we don't sleep as well. We have elevated cortisol levels, and so part of what I'm trying to do when I'm making the recommendation to sleep in a completely black room is that we are finally, for once, turning that signal of light off, and it's to try to make the best that we can out of the situation that we're living in. If people aren't using electric light, even if they were just using like fire and candles and stuff like that, the wavelength is quite different than our electric lights, and the intensity is quite different. And so, you know, if we're actually getting some daytime sunlight on our person and in our eyes, and then we experience sunset, and then we had some very modest light sources, I wouldn't be as freaked out about pestering people about trying to sleep in a completely dark room. But the reality is that people don't live that way. Typically people don't do these things. So the completely dark room is just the last ditch effort to really try to shut off all wavelengths of light going into our eyes and try to get the best, most sound sleep that we can. And so, from this evolutionary perspective, we typically didn't experience absolute blackness all the time, absolute dark. But overall, our total photo period was quite different and much less typically than what we're getting now. And so it's interesting because we don't get the peaks, the extremes. And again, Art Devaney has talked about this stuff for a long time. We don't get the extremes of photo exposure, like being out in the noonday sun and getting that both on our skin and in our eyes and all the kind of biophysical effects that we get from that. So we don't get the extremes, but then we are scrunched into this kind of gray zone middle land where we're not out in the sun, but then when we're indoors, even at night, we have reasonably high output lighting that is suppressing melatonin production and is kind of accentuating cortisol production. And we have Dr. Kirk Parsley coming on the show, I believe the show after this one, and he's a sleep expert, has former Navy SEAL, has worked with the West Coast SEALs for a number of years, and we talk about a lot of this stuff further. But I did a blog post. I think the title is like Sleep, 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 so it shouldn't be too hard to find. So check that one out, and it kind of gives a little bit more of the how's whys, what's it's behind all this.
Yeah, you just got to remember that it's not a historical reenactment. I think that trips a lot of people up. This is not what cavemans did. Well, that's not what anyone is saying. Well, it's not. Some people are saying that, but they shouldn't be.
Yeah, and you know where you can spackle something together. Like I try to go to bed as early as it is humanly possible, having a kid, and like in the evening we've put dimmer switches on all the lights in the house. So in the evening, I tend to flip on the dimmer switches. If I have to do some computer work, I use my F-Lux program. And my sleep is way better when I do that. You know, like one of the bummers of traveling is that I don't kind of have that that environmental control, and my sleep isn't as good. So, you know, to the degree that we can control some of this stuff, then I think you use the, you know, the kind of caveman model to make some informed decisions. But then from there, we just kind of do the best damage control that we can.
Okay.
Talk peanut butter.
Well,
peanut butter.
Ready as I'm going to be. Tyler says, conventional wizodom says it's a great source of protein, but fats, but the paleo community is quick to avoid it like the plague. If there are any benefits, would organic be a step in the right direction, or does it really matter? Please put this one to rest once and for all on my extra chunky vice that is peanut butter. P.S. The show rocks. If it were up to me, I would give you guys a spot on primetime TV and fire the idiots who thought it would be a good idea to have actors play doctor and give health advice to millions every day. Good luck with that.
Yeah, I don't think we'd make it on primetime too long. So, you know, the deal with peanut butter, it is delicious. The worst peanut butter in the world is better tasting than the best almond butter that I've ever had. Like, there's just no two ways about it. Peanut butter is a gift from Satan himself as far as the flavor goes. The bummer with peanut butter, kind of two pieces. Typically, it's a reasonably potent source of aflatoxin, which is a mutagenic, teratogenic mold byproduct. Really nasty for the liver. Not nice stuff. Interestingly, you get more aflatoxin from organic peanut butter than you do from the Monsanto-ized, you know, herbicide, fungicide, sprayed, conventional stuff. So that's just kind of an interesting aside. Peanuts as a immunogenic item, and sometime we'll get Matt Lalonde back on the show, and he can go down the rabbit hole pretty deep on this. But the type of proteins that are found in peanuts are very, very irritating to the body, and they have kind of two interesting features. One, they are pretty crafty at making it through the gut intact, like peanut lectin. We can feed people peanuts, and then we can see increased concentrations of these immunogenic proteins in their circulation. And this is possibly part of the reason why so many people have all of these really severe peanut allergies. Like, it ranges from hives all the way to up to an anaphylactic shock that can kill somebody. And it, occasionally when I'm on a flight, you know, you'll get the stewardess chiming in over the intercom saying, we have somebody who has a peanut allergy. Please don't eat any type of peanut products, because the closed confines of a plane and the recirculated air, person in the front of the plane is eating a bag of peanuts, person in the back of the plane is allergic to peanuts, and the person in the back of the plane can go into anaphylactic shock from that. And without an EpiPen and some medical intervention, the person can die, depending on the severity. Now, is everybody reactive to this same way? Absolutely not. There's a huge spectrum of reactivity, just like, you know, all of these things. But there is some, whenever we have a pro-inflammatory kind of situation, then we increase the likelihood of atherosclerosis, and there's some pretty good studies showing the atherogenicity of peanuts and peanut products. We have increased likelihood of autoimmune diseases. You know, clearly allergies and stuff like that are increased, you know, kind of problem. So, you know, peanut butter is one of those things that I just encourage people to, again, pull it out of the diet, reintroduce it, see how you do. It is delicious stuff. I wish somebody would come up with a low allergenicity peanut butter that, you know, maintained the other, you know, it's got some nice monounsaturated fats. The protein content is okay, although it's a, you know, it's a third world protein. So I'm not hanging my hat on that as a protein source, but the shit is delicious. I mean, it's just yummy as all get out, and, you know, feels like soul food. It's so yummy. So I wish they would cook up a low allergenic variety of peanut butter that still tasted good and, you know, didn't then cause my testicles to fall off because of whatever genetic tinkering that they did with it. But that, I guess that's kind of the big picture deal with peanut butter. Delicious, but potentially harmful, but clearly a broad spectrum of reactivity to it. And so that's where it's kind of left up to you guys to do some tinkering with it if you so choose, and if you just want to upend
the jar of extra chunky Skippy that's salted. Oh man, my mouth's watering even thinking about it. And you go to town.
One of the CrossFit NorCal memories that's seared into my brain is you sitting at the front desk just eating like an entire jar of macadamia nut butter with a spoon.
That just stuff is pretty good.
Just going to town on that thing.
That runs up there close to a good jar of peanut butter.
It's pretty incredible.
It's damn fine for a mass game.
Yeah. Okay. Nikhil or something like that says, "Hey guys, great show. Keep it going. Been paleo since 2010 and am loving the really positive benefits it's had to my health. My question has to do with recommended paleo snacks for snack bars. There's a snack bar at my job, and it's filled with the usual foolishness like Snickers, M&Ms, and other stuff. It's pretty successful. People love junk food. I want to replace the present junk food with paleo-friendly snacks, but I need to convince my boss that things will sell and add a good profit. I was thinking of buying some bulk purchases of high-quality paleo-type snacks online to save money. What paleo snacks do you guys recommend that I can use to undermine this sugary stronghold? Thanks." Perhaps wellfoodsco.com
might have some. Possibly wellfoods.com, yeah. I mean, we have some great stuff in there, and I definitely still, you know, other than the jerky, I think jerky kind of passes muster as a food, you know, maybe a quasi-food or, a snack food. But the almond cookies and all the rest of that, definitely snacks, definitely on the more treaty, quasi-junk foody kind of side of the equation, but they're gluten-free, they're portable, they have a decent shelf life. When I've done some pretty extensive backpacking and stuff, I've grabbed the almond cookies, and they're just very nutrient dense. They have a good amount of carbs, good amount of fat, not a ton of protein, but I chew on a little bit of jerky, and they're just really nice and portable and tasty and all that. I know there are a ton of other, you know, there's like paleo treats and caveman treats. There's a zillion different things out there. I don't know about price point relative to, you know, like Almond Joy and Snickers and stuff like that. I suspect the price point on paleo snacks is probably going to suck. But I don't know. You know, they definitely are. I would say they're generally healthier options just because we're avoiding gluten. Typically, it's not quite as much sugar. There's still a little more nutrition in there as far as like vitamins and minerals and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, it's snack food. Like it's not it's not going to get you on Jack Street eating that stuff like morning, noon, and night. Anybody who tells you that it will is lying, or you've got an incredible amount of gear that you're taking, in which case at some point, I guess, bad diet can be overwhelmed by some amount of anabolic use. So the West Side guys seem to be testament to that. So that's all I got for you. There's a lot of different options out there. Check them out. If you want to check out Well Food, shoot Kate an email. I'm sure that she would hook you up with a wholesale account if you wanted to offer that stuff at work and be able to have some margin to be able to make a little bit of money. That's what our whole affiliate program is about. So that's about all I got.
Cool. All right. Marco says.
The last one?
Yep. Hi, Rob and Greg. Awesome. Last year, I visited a dermatologist and paid $180 for a five-minute chat about my skin. Fuck him. He told me not to train. What dermatologist tells you not to train? For the past 3 years of my life, I've been diagnosed with tinea versicolor. For the most part, I don't really mind looking like a leopard, but it does bother me from time to time and when my skin becomes red and itchy. I know it's much more prevalent in hot environments, so that sucks because I live in Australia and it's pretty humid here. I also train in BJJ with a couple of sessions of weightlifting and kettlebell work during the week. I don't plan on stopping BJJ, so I know that probably won't help the condition. After some digging around, I found some natural remedies such as aloe vera gel and Saprox that might work. There's also some info on selenium supplementation and treating tinea versicolor. Is there anything you suggest? Foods to avoid or eat more of? Supplements, herbals, hippie crap, etc.? Your help is greatly appreciated. Thanks for all the coffee-fueled drives to university while listening to your podcasts.
Hippie crap should cure everything. It should be like Chuck Norris tears.
Right?
You would think. But this tinea versicolor is a skin-borne fungal infection. I'm surprised that there's not some sort of like a topical, like
Mitronidazole or something like that that could be helpful. Tea tree topically might be helpful. Doing if you can track down like a good
yeast protocol, which is basically like a ketogenic type GAPS diet kind of deal, where you know super low carb, starve out the yeast. Some people use some wormwood and some different stuff, trying to make sure that they cover all the other potential gut pathogens. This is where tracking down a solid functional medicine doctor can help you, because they will have an established protocol that you won't need to, you know, make up all the parts and pieces. But it seems like some sort of an antifungal protocol, starting at the gut level and then working outwards.
Clearly, a ketogenic or low-carb approach is going to suck with BJJ. Yeah, there's just no two ways around that. That's not going to be great, but it seems like that. And then maybe even, you know, I'm surprised again that there's not some sort of like a topical kind of ointment, cream, antifungal agent that could be used to kind of prop this up. I know there are some oral antifungal agents also, and they're not super benign on the liver, but I'm just curious if there could be any possibilities there where you double whammy this thing, ketogenic diet, yeast protocol, dietarily and kind of lifestyle wise, get some sun, and then some sort of an oral antifungal potentially, but which clearly you'd have to go back to your GP or possibly the dermatologist might be helpful there, but it sounds like they're pretty unhelpful all the way around. So that's what I've got on that. Like, it seems like there should be some way to address this. It's a fungal infection. Seems like there should be some way to address this, but again, it would probably start at the gut level and then work outwards.
Cool. Dude, all right.
Dunsky.
Is that it?
I think that's it. What else have we got? Anything new, exciting you need to tell people?
No. Go check out performancemenu.com or you'll regret it. You'll have bad dreams.
Or Greg will track you down in your sleep and duct tape you to your bed.
Yes.
It's after always feeding possible. You a bunch of water. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, dude. So 180 in the books. Next week we have Dr. Kirk Parsley talking sleep. And other shenanigans. Episode 100 of the Performance Menu is screaming forward here. Cool. I think that's it.
Totally cool.
Awesome, man. That was a high energy podcast if ever there was one.
Oh, goodness. All righty.
Yep. All right, man. We'll talk to you soon.
See ya.
Later, G.